And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries, metaphysical topics, and unfiltered, non-corporate news of the day. So today we're really going to dig into the ancient astronaut theory. I have a great expert on the subject. Welcome to the show, Neil Freer.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and Mike.
Thank you. Coming from Santa Fe, New Mexico, a great place. Why don't you tell me how you got involved with studying this ancient astronaut theory?
Oh, wow.
Or just kind of a thumbnail sketch.
Well, I'll be totally frank and open and honest about it. When in 1936, I was apparently abducted by aliens. In 1942, at the age of 12, I was again contacted. It wasn't exactly an abduction. It was four of the little gray fellows. I woke up in the middle of the night. They were holding me horizontal, and the larger alien at my head, the sergeant, so to speak, they let me wake up, and they apparently wanted, it was a very pleasant experience, and they wanted it to be that way, and the sergeant was obviously prompting me telepathically to ask questions. And I said, well, what are you guys? You know, what's happening here? And he said, we're androids. This is 1946.
Right.
Way before
Roswell and all
Roswell
that.
And all that kind of stuff. And he gave me to believe, he gave me to understand it, that they were a combination of human, and android meant that they were a combination of humanoid and robot. That was the best word he could use, I guess, at that particular point for me. And I had not been reading science fiction or anything like that, but it was so real. And I wanted to know who the management was, because they obviously were androids. And he gave me a glimpse of this big husky gent with a black and white beard, gray and white beard, back, who was actually running the show. And the word Anunnaki, when I asked who they were,
wow.
The word, it was either Anunnaki or Anakim, something
amazing.
Like that. And the whole purpose of the pickup was to ask me politely, even at 12 years old, and respectfully, if I would help them get introduced back into the planet. And I, you know, by the nature of the situation, I agreed, you know. And this sergeant put some big chunk of information into my head through some subcortical channel, and I was an information junkie by that time anyway, and I thought, wow, that's great, but I couldn't understand it. And he said, well, you won't understand that until much later on, until you're much, much older, you know, like in your 70s. Well, I happen to be 76 and a half at this particular point.
Okay.
And so, to answer your question directly, that contact, it hasn't reoccurred over my lifetime. I did a few years ago, two or three years ago, sitting here in my office looking out at the mountains in Santa Fe. I said, you know, guys, I could use a little reinforcement here. And about a month later, below the mountains, as I look at them, and about maybe 15 miles out, a few craft came by. I thought they were F-16s at first, but they were flying in formation, but they weren't. They were just going along like kids on bicycles, you know, moving front and back of each other and stuff. And I saw that they had no wings and no tails, and I thought, well, okay, thanks very much. You know, that's great. And I happen to have I'm an instrument-rated pilot, private pilot, and I called the tower over at Santa Fe and asked if he had anything on the radar scope, and I gave him the direction and everything. He said, no, I don't see anything out there.
Wow, so they gave you that confirmation.
Yeah.
What I want to ask you is, take us back to Sumeria about 4000 B.C. Give us an idea of what society was like. It appears that the Anunnaki were directly interacting with human beings at that point.
Well, to just make a segue here,
okay.
that obviously that contact and that impetus has followed me over my life, and I've, you know, they came back in 3 or 4 months when I was awake, just going to bed, big light came down over the house, My father was a cop. He was a policeman. He was having a cup of coffee with my mother in the kitchen. And I called him, and he took off the old top-hung wooden storm window, put it in the living room on the second floor, and he's sitting on the windowsill outside. And I am, too, looking up into this light, and there was a craft there. No noise. And then it shot off into space like, you know, Star Trek going into warp drive and that kind of typical stuff. And he looked at me, and I said, well, that must be the little guys, you know. And obviously they were coming back to reinforce the parents that who had gone to the priest about this were totally bent out of shape. My mother said, what's an android? And so, they were confirming that the kid wasn't totally bonkers.
Right.
But it's been an impetus all my life, I'm sure.
I see.
And they have they said that they would watch out for me on a physical basis, and that's the basis of this, I'm sure. And
you said a key phrase. You said they want to get back on the planet. My research indicates they were very involved in this planet around 4000 BC, but they withdrew at a certain point. And that's kind of what I want to get at with you.
Okay. Sumeria, I think, in a nutshell, can be described as the Anunnaki, the alien civilization from the last of the 10th planet in our solar system, which was rediscovered, obviously, I'm convinced, certain, as Zechariah Sitchin has pointed out also, that they, you know, rediscovered that planet in 83, 84 with the Iris satellite, and it was then covered up because everybody knows that, and that's their home planet. And they said they came from there. They landed here 432,000 years ago, colonized the planet, were taking huge amounts of gold out, and then 200,000 years ago had a rebellion in the gold mine. As those who are familiar with Zechariah Sitchin's work, I think that Zechariah Sitchin should get a Nobel Prize. They invented us, literally, genetically, to take the place of their gold miners in South Africa, and currently it is known to the mining community in South Africa that when they have said in their mining journals, they don't go looking for gold with a pick and shovel geologically anymore. They go looking for ancient gold mines, and they have found gold mines 100,000 years old.
Amazing.
Which is, to us who have, you know, been familiar with this material, is no surprise whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so we got invented as a slave species by them crossing their genes with Homo erectus, upgrading Homo erectus, and here we are. And that's the basis for all of the exceedingly anomalous and strange kind of gene code that we have. Recently they have found that there's 3,141 sites on our gene code that can go, you know, practically blink and they'll go haywire, whereas every other species on this planet has like maybe 2, 3, 6 or none of that kind of stuff. And so invented as a slave species, but by 4000 BC, where we need to focus, they realized that they were going to phase off the planet.
I see.
And so Sumeria, which is called even by mainstream archaeologists who don't want to even look at the new paradigm and Sitchin's material, call it a sudden civilization, which means that all of a sudden, literally, without any real predecessors whatsoever, we have a civilization that had advanced politics, economy, learning,
art, music,
trilingual dictionaries, arts and music, and
strange language called cuneiform.
Cuneiform, right? And so I think it is best described as a crash course in civilization. In other words, they knew that they were going to phase off, and they did two things. They instructed us by setting up this civilization and helping us set it up to learn how to survive as a species and prosper and flourish on this planet once they had gone. Now, at the same time, as those who are familiar with Sir Lawrence Gardner's recent publications and books and work. Again, I think Sir Lawrence, both of these gentlemen, Zechariah Sitchin and Sir Lawrence, I'm good friends with. I know them well, and I have the utmost respect for their integrity and meticulous scholarship. And I think that they both should get a Nobel Prize, probably a Peace Prize, actually, as we can talk about later. They set up Sumeria of the Anunnaki, meaning those who came down from the heavens, set up a crash course in civilization called Sumeria. And that carried over into the Egyptians and so on. But they also did a very significant kind of manipulation too, genetically, at that time. Enki, who was the one of two brothers, Enki and Enlil.
Right, the more benevolent one, right?
More benevolent, more sympathetic to humans because he was our creator in the first place. You know, he and his half-sister in Ninhursag did the work 200,000 years before that in the laboratory just above the gold mines that they invented this for. And so what he did is he selected a human female. I don't know how he applied quality control, but he selected a human female and fathered a child with her to insert more Anunnaki genes in our gene code, which was already part Anunnaki and part Homo erectus. And so the child that was fathered, his name was Cain, and from which comes Cain, kinship, Cainship, as Sir Lawrence has pointed out. And what he was doing was instituting a line of foremen, kings, mm-hmm. who would eventually be trained and take over the leadership of the people. And the injunction, the whole purpose of their thing, of their kingship, they were instructed to be servants of the people. And so in Sumerian, that kingship line was called Graal, special kingship, and that line was trained in advanced schools, which over time we've come to call mystery schools. They weren't mystery schools. There was no mystery about them at all. They taught this bloodline and other humans that were selected advanced science, mathematics, astronomy particularly, so that they'd know when to look for the 10th planet, the home planet of the Anunnaki, coming back into the solar system every 3,600 years, because when it comes back in, and we can talk about this later, because it's a very significant thing that may be happening now, all hell can break loose on this planet because of the disturbance of the solar system as it comes in on a huge cometary orbit. But so Sumeria was set up as a crash course in civilization. And
is this royal bloodline Abraham, Moses, David, going down to Jesus? Is that the sacred bloodline?
That's the one, okay. And it actually is. The etymology is very interesting of the word Graal in Sumerian, meaning special bloodline, special kingship line, because it etymologically can be traced up through Graal, Sangreal, Holy Grail. So this is the Holy Grail. This is the Grail bloodline, and it's not a cup in a saucer. Not a cup in a saucer or a sword stuck in a rock or any of that stuff. It's a kingship line, and that I think puts Sumeria in perspective, and the kingship line. We can continue our talk about that because.
Well, obviously that leads down to Jesus. Now, do you believe it ended there, or do you believe he had offspring and it continues to this day?
Oh, no, it obviously continues to this day. It is diversified, this dispersed into the population, but it exists right now, and Sir Lawrence Gardner has done all of the genealogical work, with having worked for 30 royal families in Europe. He was enlisted employed as a genealogist to work for them, and he also was part of some of the other societies that surrounded the royal families in Europe. And as a genealogist, he discovered, as he had unique access to their private archives, that as he traced their heritages and genealogical lines back, where they had very good records that were kept over centuries and centuries and centuries, he saw that there was this bloodline of kings that he eventually traced all the way back to Sumeria. And so he would say to these people, well, what is this bloodline here that is in all these records, but nobody seems to talk about? And they said, well, did you find my great-great-great-grandfather or something? He said, no, what is this bloodline? And they finally said, well, look, we know about this, but we've kept this all in the woodwork because this was the focus of the Inquisition. So what we see is that this bloodline came from Sumeria, of special kings to be take over when the Anunnaki finally phased off, or phased back. Some phased back, stayed on the planet. Some phased off, apparently, if Sitchin's translations and interpretations are correct. And it came from Sumeria through the Egyptians. It came through the Hebrews and now we know from the Dead Sea Scroll material, it came through the Essenes. The Essenes were a group of seemingly ascetics who lived out in the wilderness, but they had a very highly developed, I was going to say civilization, but society is a better word. And they actually, the men and the women, lived almost a monastic life where the women and men stayed separate at certain times of the year and were only allowed to come together, man and wife, were only allowed to come together at certain times of the year because they wanted the children, the new kings in that bloodline, to be fathered at a certain time, to be procreated at a certain time of the year, and to be born in a certain time of the year. And so Jesus and Mary, if Sir Lawrence's work in detail has gone back to determine this and is correct, and I after heavy-duty analysis of both Zechariah's work and Lawrence's work, I'm convinced that they have hit it right on the nose.
Okay.
Sir Lawrence says that Jesus and Mary were both Essene officials, that they were fathering children in the bloodline. Jesus was in the bloodline, and it went back through the Davids and so on. And that brings up the whole notion of the Old Testament and the Bible, why certain books were not in there, why certain books are, why we have finally realized, and most scholars who have any kind of integrity and honesty will have to admit that the Old Testament is not some kind of revelation by some a divinity that showed up here at certain times and communicated this stuff, but it is a rewrite by the Levite priest in captivity, in captivity in Babylon, having access to all of the huge superior libraries in Babylon that had come down from the ancient times, from Sumeria and so on. The Old Testament is a rewrite of the ancient Sumerian records. A single example, for instance, is the idea of the flood. In the Old Testament, we have sort of this. The flood is obviously a very significant effect, and with a capital F, because it was so destructive. But the Old Testament kind of tells it in a children's story, like two giraffes and two hippopotamuses. And
Noah's Ark,
going up the ramp into the ark that Noah had built. Well, when you actually go back to reading the original in the Sumerian, we find that Utnapishtim, who was the name that Noah had in the ancient Sumerian, was related to Enki, to what he had agreed to in the Council of the Anunnaki, to let everybody get all humans to be wiped out when this great catastrophe was going to happen. They knew it was going to happen because it was going to be caused by their planet coming in through the inner solar system in between Mars and Jupiter. They could predict it, and they knew under these conditions that it was going to happen under, all hell was going to break loose. And so they had decided to let humans go down the drain. But Enki decided, no, I can't go along with this. He went to this Utnapishtim, Noah, and gave him instructions about how to build an ark that was actually a submersible, apparently. It floated level, not on top of the waters like a boat does, but level with the waters so that it would be most stable in the rocking and of the huge waves. And and when he took on board what most probably was seed and genetic material rather than actual, you know, two cows and two horses.
That makes much more sense.
Sure. And we did get lucky and survive. But if anyone is really interested in seeing the extent of that catastrophe, I highly recommend a book called Cataclysm by Alan and Dallaire, a geologist and geophysicist from England, who have 235 footnotes average per section of this book. I mean, this is research like you can hardly believe. And they have gone all over the planet, and they realize that when you trace it back to about 9,500 BC, there was indeed a cataclysmic event that occurred on Earth, but it was not just like some tsunami coming up out of Antarctica and covering the Middle East and then washing back down. As you know, you could easily understand or conceive of from the Old Testament. And so what actually happened was mountains were shoved up, seas were emptied, new seas created. The entire globe was rocked by a cataclysm that disturbed things. They believe that the Himalayas, which have, at the top of the Himalayas, they had discovered, Mount Everest even, they have discovered embedded in the ground clamshells.
Wow.
and those clamshells are closed, which means those clams were killed like instantly because they were alive at that point. If they were dead, the clamshells would have been open. And on top of the Andes in South America, it is a commonly known thing that they had discovered all kinds of seashells and stuff, and that those mountains are very young. Well, when you put everything together, not only has Alan and Dallaire put together all of this information and shown that all over the world there are caves and fissures where compacted into them from the driving force of wind and rain and waves and water pressure, there are the remains of trees and humans and animals and plants compressed in there, and obviously the effect of a cataclysmic event. And this is common all over the world. But what is really fascinating about their work is that when you go to there's another whole section of the book where they go through the quote unquote myths, but they're not really myths that exist from literally the survivors, because they judge that humans survived in maybe hundreds or maybe a couple of thousand all over the planet. And so what we're really looking at is stories of the survivors. For instance, the Hopi Indians say we always thought they were legends and mythological, imaginings. They say that their first Hopi came up out of the ground. And you'd think at first reading that it was like a matter of them sort of conceiving of themselves naively as growing out of the ground like plants or something, or emerging. But what it really is, when Alan and Dallaire are going back into this, is that those people, the ancestors of the Hopi, had gotten lucky and survived in caves, which they said, by eating the animals in there at the time of the flood.
That's amazing.
And then when they came out, they literally had to claw themselves out of these caves in the ground, or in the mountains or whatever, to begin to survive again.
Yeah.
And then we know, too, for instance, that many of those legends tell about when they did get a chance to come back out, that eventually white men with beards and long robes, this is repeated in a number of legends all over the world, showed up to teach them the basics of survival and civilization again.
So the Anunnaki, basically.
And I have to say that it is, I can't prove it, but I think it is obvious by the logic of the situation that the Anunnaki actually traveled the world and you know, helped us out.
Sure. Now, tell me about before the flood. Were there a lot more genetic manipulations and giants being created?
I don't see that from the literature. I'm not a geneticist, and I'm not a geologist, and I'm not an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
But from all of the work that not only Sitchin and Gardner, but a number of other people have done. Lloyd Pye, for instance, has in a book called
Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Yeah, that's a great title.
Yeah, that's a pretty fundamental place to start with. I know Lloyd well, a good friend, and I have respect for his work. And, he points out a number of these things. And I don't think that we saw too much genetic manipulation. I still think, I believe now that we have to hold for a while on that, because if we get lucky and we can find a Homo erectus skeleton or remains that we can identify positively as Homo erectus before literally Homo erectus got genetically manipulated to create us, and we can compare that to our genetics and also to the genetics of samples that we have gotten lucky to get from Neanderthals. We've got a constellation of two or three, maybe even four possible genetic codes that we could compare to, because I don't think we have totally explained the Neanderthals as of yet. Because the Neanderthals didn't go out of existence, until maybe what, 35,000, 40,000 years ago, and they had some basic culture. They buried their dead, I believe. They were physiologically different than we are, but I can't tell. I don't know, as we can tell from the ancient records, whether or not they were a particular genetic manipulation that the Anunnaki did also. And it's going to be fascinating to see, because we coexisted with the Neanderthals, and at the same time, at the same time that the Neanderthals were seemingly going extinct, we had already musical instruments. You know, we've got 35,000-year-old flutes from caves in France or Spain, and the cave drawings are still admired by artists to this day, and I quite honestly they were done by us. And of course we've got this whole business of when did men, humans, actually populate North and South America? Well, we were talking about Clovis 12,000 years ago, maybe at the outside, Clovis points and the Clovis culture in the United States. And then you would get things like finds of 25,000-year-old human remains and campsites in South America where they couldn't believe what they were looking at, and they called in, I could remember her name. There was a woman archaeologist who actually was working for the United States government at that time. Maybe her name will come to me. I'm really frustrated when I can't do that.
But in other words, very, very old artifacts. We're winding down the interview. We only have 5 minutes left. Tell me about the Lost Book of Enoch in the Bible that seems to describe a lot of this Anunnaki.
It probably does, but it's in such a kind of watered-down, misinterpreted mess that I pretty much just figured the best thing to do is just set that aside and go back and read the ancient records.
I see. Go to the source, right?
Yeah, go to the source. I mean, the Old Testament, for instance, as Gardner has pointed out, the whole business with Noah, with Moses. Moses, according to the translations and work that Gardner has done, was a Moses, a high official. He was not Moses as we know him in the Bible. He was actually Akhenaten, who was gotten very unpopular in Egypt and got thrown out and took a bunch of Hebrew captives with him. And they were coming back, and they went up on, there was no Mount Sinai at that time, even though the Bible calls it that. There was no Mount Sinai. It was Mount Horeb. And on Mount Horeb was where Jethro, whose daughter Moses married, was running a big foundry that was creating a monatomic gold, the white powder gold, which we could talk about some other time. Moses was Akhenaten, and he got all his information and training from Jethro, whose daughter he married, it says, even in the Bible, and the Ten Commandments that he was supposed to have received from some cosmic god, who turns out to be Enlil, Enki's brother,
Jehovah, right?
Jehovah Yahweh, which means that the Judeo-Christian god is a humanoid alien from the 10th century.
And Anunnaki.
You know, and this is why I wrote the book in 1987 that I did called Breaking the God Spell. We've got to get out from underneath all this stuff because we're being invited into stellar society, and the rules are you don't go until you're a peaceful, united planetary species that's got their act together, and you don't take weapons into space. And the only way we're going to get to be peaceful species is to restore a true history to ourselves, recognize that we're genetically engineered creatures, and that we come together on that basis of common, generic humanity, and so on. But the Ten Commandments, for instance, are clearly almost verbatim in verse 125 of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which was way back, maybe 1,000 years, something like that,
or
before the time of so-called Moses.
Right, but who do you believe created the Anunnaki? Do you believe it's the supreme god of the whole universe?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, the whole notion of a creator god is simply a sublimation of the function that the obviously superior race to us, at least at the time of our creation, it's a humanoid, human anthropomorphic projection on the universe. And this is not atheism. I'm not saying there isn't some kind of principle that can create, you know, a zillion universes on Wednesday afternoon and play games with them. I'm simply saying that we need to see, to get out from underneath the God spell, the subservient attitude towards some kind of creator God who's a nasty ass, quite honestly. Even Enlil, Jehovah Yahweh said in the Old Testament, I'm a peevish God. And what was his first commandment, so to speak? I am your Lord, your God, and don't you damn well forget it. And don't go over the borders and work for my brothers and my cousins.
Right, I'm a jealous and angry God. Well, with that, we have to conclude the interview. Your great guest, Neil Freer. Your website is neilfreer.com, N-E-I-L-F-E-R-E-E-R.com. Thank you for joining us today.
You got that wrong, Mike. N-E-I-L-F-R-E-E-R.
Okay, I'm glad you corrected me. .com.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Neil. Take care.
Take care.
Okay, that was a fascinating guest. And he just has so many different interesting topics about the ancient mysteries and ancient astronauts. So just a couple of things before Candia joins us, my co-host. I want to tell you about my website. I'm at fountainsofuse.net, and I have the two DVDs out on ancient mysteries, The Sands of Time and The Temples of Stone. And I've been lecturing all up and down the West Coast and across the nation, and definitely like to get out there and lecture and show my slides and presentation about all of these ancient monuments. So if you're interested in having me as a lecturer in your community, contact me through the website at fountainsofuse.net. And I hope all of you in my audience that listen each Thursday buy the DVDs, The Sands of Time and The Temple of the Stone. It's great to get together with a group of people and just watch the film and dialogue with it and have fun with it and discuss different opinions and interpretations. So that's one thing I really hope, you know, my audience really does. And I also have salt lamps on the website. I really believe in them. I believe they're really healing in the environment, and you turn them on and they're like a beautiful nightlight. I even have one that's called a rainbow salt lamp, and it has many different colors. It turns at night, like red, blue, green, purple, orange, yellow. And it disperses negative ions into the air, which are the same ions that you feel when you stand under a waterfall or go to the beach and the waves are crashing. And they're actually very good for you and very healthy, and that's why you feel so refreshed when you go to the beach. So you're flooding your environment with these salt negative ions. And they're really important to put by a computer so you balance out that energy as well. And these rocks are from the Himalaya Mountains, and they have a beautiful wood base. So check them out on my website at fountainsofuse.net. And they're priced quite right, so you can afford them. So anyway, there's been a lot in the news lately. Certainly the Discovery Channel is going to have a fascinating documentary this Sunday. James Cameron, the director of the Titanic, is talking about the lost tomb of Jesus, and he says he's discovered it, so we all definitely have to watch that show or tape it. I don't watch a whole lot of TV, but this should be interesting this Sunday, and we can talk about that a bit more next week. I'm also going to have a guest on chemtrails next week, so in the meantime, I'd like my audience to check out websites and internet sites on chemtrails. Not that you can believe everything on a website, of course, but you can at least get a feel for a subject. So it's spelled C-H-E-M-T-R-A-I-L-S, chemtrails. And you can Yahoo that or Google that and find out about all those strange lines up in the sky. I went to a lecture last night, very fascinating. A lady named Mary Sterrett from the Constitution Party. And that's actually the fastest growing third party. A lot of people are just fed up with the two parties. And the Constitution Party, they really run everything by the actual Constitution. If it goes along with that precious document, then they believe in it. And if it doesn't, they don't believe in it. That's their litmus test. And she got 50,000 votes when she ran for governor in Oregon. So that's pretty good. It's like I said, it's quite a fast-growing party. And I'm somewhat involved with it. And they are talking about dismantling the Federal Reserve Bank, which is a privately owned cartel of banks, and was kind of secretly put together back in about 1913. And they want to dismantle that, which would be a very healthy, good thing for the United States. And that's one thing Kennedy was trying to do right before he was assassinated. You can still get Kennedy dollars that were minted by the U.S. Treasury instead of the Federal Reserve. And they're still out there, the silver dollars. So that's one thing the Constitution Party wants to address, as well as a whole host of other issues like this so-called war on terror. And she was really questioning 911, and she used to work in television, and she lost her job pretty quickly after asking some really serious questions about 911 and the Pentagon and the crash in Pennsylvania and just the lack of evidence that these were jumbo jets, you know. And once again, she was fired from her television show. And that's the type of media atmosphere we have in the year 2007. And thank God we have BBS radio and great internet sites, and Coast to Coast radio is pretty good with George Norrie. He touches on a lot of these topics. So we do have some good media and some great internet websites. One of the best ones is Rense. I really like Jeff Rense. It's spelled RENSE.com. And if you go to Rense.com each week, he always has, you know, dozens and dozens of fascinating articles. And they're all by different authors, and they're all different opinions, of course. It's not like you believe every single thing you read on Rense, but at least it's unfiltered, and there's all sorts of fascinating articles. Another good one I like to go to is davidicke.com. He really has a refreshing take on the worldwide news and the war on terror and all the different wars that we constantly engage in, and a really refreshing perspective on it. So check out davidicke.com. He's linked up to the main page of bbsradio.com, and a really wonderful source of news. And now we're going to switch gears a bit and talk a little bit about metaphysics with my co-host, Candia. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
All right, so what have you been up to?
Sounds like I missed some good stuff with Dyke. Dyke's great stuff.
Yeah, David will be in Mount Shasta this summer. There's a big conference. If you go on his website, it has all the details. But I'm hoping to be there, too.
Oh, that's fabulous. Oh, that's great. It's funny thinking about the summer. Last week on the show, you were gone. We missed you, of course.
Oh, thank you.
we got into nature, spirits, and elementals and the effect on the planet. And so after that, I got so motivated about what we were talking about that I decided to do a class. So it's funny. And I'm going to do it this summer, just like, you know, David Icke is, only I'm going to do mine up on Mount St. Helens.
Wow.
You're doing it in Mount Shasta. I'm going to do it up on Mount St. Helens.
Well, tell us a bit about elementals and nature spirits and how you can contact them.
Well, that's what we talked about a little bit last week, but what since I was little, I could see fairies. Now, as an adult, I don't see them like I did. I see more of the energy, and I get a sense of them. However, with elementals, well, you know, I take that back. I've seen elementals in my mind's eye, and I've seen photographs. It's like, you know, the glow or the balls, the spheres of energy that people can capture now in photographs.
Right.
The globes of light. Well, you can catch elementals in photographs as well. And I really feel it has something to do with the digital camera. I don't know. I am not a mechanic of how you make cameras. I don't know these things. But there's something about those types of camera that catches and captures the presence of them.
What do they look like?
The one that I saw was fascinating. It was taken in a cave, and we were taking a picture of these two boys, and the boys never appeared because in the photograph all you saw was this fog in front of them. But instead, when I see them and work with them, they're more like a watercolor where you draw an image and then you put too much water on it and it spreads out, and yet there's still a definitive line. So my belief is if we start working with them in tandem, because they're not going to work with us unless we ask them to.
Yeah.
They do their job independently. But if we start working with them in tandem to help shift some of this energy on the planet in terms of the ecology, the grid lines, working with the poles, because that goes into HAARP and all those other great things, that we can amplify what we've got going and not only just work with the humans that we've got going on, you know, in terms of what you do for a living, what I do, and helping people shift at that level, but to then go in tandem with the earth energies. And if we kind of spread this energy out, I just get excited to thought about it. So that's why I decided after talking about it last week that's it. I'm doing a series of workshops. And then the last one I thought it would be really fun to do up on Mount St. Helens in the summertime.
Absolutely.
Because talk about a mountain of energy. Just because she blew her top, 27 years ago?
Right, yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean she's still cooking. She's still very alive. You know, there's a lot of alive energy up there. So I think it would be a perfect location.
Well,
you know,
this spring we'll talk about it with our audience and get some of our audience up there.
Oh, I think it would be great. And it's, again, I'm going to do this August 11th. from 10 o'clock, because I figure it'd take that long for everybody to get there, and everybody gets burly, drives up there. And then I'm going to, I don't have the exact location where we're going to meet yet, and then I want to go up on the base of Mount St. Helens and do the classes up there, and then finish up the day, I'd like to have a potluck barbecue down on Swift Reservoir.
Absolutely, and this is a nationwide show, but people have to come to the Northwest in the summer. They have to.
It's fabulous. You know, when it rains here, all I can think about is, oh, I'd rather be someplace else. However, when it's sunny, all I can think of is staying here.
Absolutely. So what topic do you have today?
Well, you know, as I've said over and over again, my topics always coincide with what has been the current event or cycles each week, because I learn every week from my clients. So it's kind of twofold. I think on some levels they're correlated and yet they're separate, because there's always a link. One is cancer, because, again, I work with people that have cancer, not a huge amount. I have to admit that, but I have to some degree. And what I have found to be true, and you can read this, I think even Louise Hay talks about this too, is that when you get into a cancer cell, there's so much anger. So my best suggestions, advice, invitation for any of those that are listening that have been challenged with cancer is to really go in and love the cells. Of course, if you've seen The Secret, they say that, you know, I love my healing. I'm so grateful for my healing. But in addition to that, I feel that you really have to go in and find the root cause as to why you were so angry, what you're so upset about. And really take the time to look at your shadow self, the darker self, the things you don't like within yourself. It's real easy to point fingers, but once you go into those emotional levels of saying, okay, what is it that I don't like? Why am I so angry? Because in essence, we're so good at blaming somebody else, but in essence, we really blame ourselves. You know, it's no different than, like, let's say you're an incest victim. In reality, you end up blaming yourself that you did something wrong to create it. Same thing with anger, is that you may blame your parents for such and such, and even though it happened 50 years ago, but it's the anger that then becomes directed at yourself for the subsequent behavior that's followed it, that where you didn't step out of and change things. So those are the key issues. Again, I was just at the hospital all day the other day with, you know, in the cancer ward. So it's one of those things that I would highly invite people. I mean, cancer is not the number one killing issue in America, but it's right up there. So we've got a lot of angry people out there. So, again, my view is to really take the time to look inside, look at the shadow self. If you need assistance, go have, you know, a counselor, a psychologist, an intuitive, a healer, whatever it takes for you to start addressing these issues. And then once you get the negatives, this is the amazing part. Once you take the time to write down all the negatives and to really accept them and realize, oh, yeah, that's really kind of how I feel about myself, because it's just really a belief. And then you have the opportunity to switch it and put it into a positive.
Seen clients remove their cancer through their beliefs?
To be honest with you, not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet. But I've seen a lot of other incredible things in terms of people changing their lives and their healing on other levels. Now, there are all kinds of different levels of disease. Cancer just happened to be one I was dealing with this week. So I
sure.
haven't. Because what happens, what I have found with people that have had cancer, they get so far down the rabbit hole that it's really hard to pull them back up. And this is just my belief, is so much of it is because once you get sucked into the medical profession and saying you have to do this and you have to chemo that and radiate this and
right.
you get caught up in their diagnosis. And it's really hard when we give our power away to the doctors that say, well, you obviously know more than I do about the human body, because yes, they have studied more, but they don't know more about your body and the reason it got there. And
right.
That's why I haven't seen it yet. Now, the woman I was with 2 days ago, I feel has a great opportunity of changing her cancer, because she had lost a child a year ago, and the anger and the hurt over that. Well, she finally recognized through some work that the bottom line issue was the fact that she didn't want to be here anymore. So she went through all the different layers and levels of emotional hurts, pains, and angers, and then flipped them over, like I was saying, into the positive, saying, you know what, I have three other children to live for.
I see.
And that's how I feel very, very confident about her recovery.
Well, the type of cancer you have in the part of the body, wouldn't that indicate the type of anger you have?
Absolutely. And hers was in her it was breast cancer. Now, of course, when I look at breast cancer, the missing link on that is, for a woman, that's where we give life to our children. And it's where we also take away our own life, because we end up in today's world expecting to do so many things. I mean, a woman still has to be the nurturer most of the time. Fathers are coming more and more into the fold, but it's still so much the responsibility, especially when the children are little, falls onto the mother. And then, of course, the cost of living is up. So many women have to work today. It's very challenging to do it all. And so what's the first thing that gives in the process is time for yourself and nurturing yourself and that love towards the inward person that the mother, the wife is. And that's where I feel we've really lost that link, is that women have forgotten to nurture themselves and give life back into themselves. And once they get that concept, I think that's when you have the opportunity to really turn it around. But and I totally agree. Where you find different cancers, there's definitely different angers, whether it's in the stomach area or the intestinal area or the sexual area or whatever. There are definite emotions that are linked to that. Now, what's interesting, you could take, like Louise Hay kind of takes an overall view of the emotions linked per organ. I don't necessarily agree with every one of her assessments just because of years of working with individuals. I do feel that there are some generalities that can be looked at, and for those who are interested, it's Louise Hay. Oh, golly.
She's amazing with illnesses, yeah.
You
can heal your life.
Yeah, but she goes into the specific, what is it, your body can, I can't remember the name of it right now.
But you can go to her website.
Yeah, go to Louise Hay, but I have found, though, that this is where it's really fun. We are all so unique. Everyone is so unique that you can't always put a generality on it, because somebody's issue might not be the person right next to you, and yet you could be experiencing similar symptoms. So I don't feel that you can blanket everything. It's just, and that's what makes life so exciting, because we are all so unique. Everyone has their own blueprint. Everyone is special. And we need every one of us here to make up the whole. Everybody
Absolutely.
Has their
life. I want to ask you something I've been meaning to ask, because you have your own business with your own clients, and a lot of people in our audience are in that position. How do you manifest clients if you're not getting enough?
Well, I start my day by being so grateful for what I do. I just am so grateful for what I do. I love what I do. And then somebody will call me, and then we'll get to talking, and then they'll go, you know what, I've got somebody I think I should send to you. They call that person, and then they come to me.
Uh-huh.
And it amazes me how it just keeps going. Now, what is fascinating, it's so cool that you ask, because if my attitude goes sideways, and this is where I always say, it's all about me, it's all about you, is when I am off, my clients will drop off. When I am positive, my business is booming.
I see.
So it's a real fascinating, and that goes with anything and everything. You know, from being an electrician to being a doctor to being a lawyer, it doesn't matter. Whatever you do for a living is irrelevant. It's all in your attitude. It's all about you.
So start with being grateful.
Yeah, every day. Even when it's hard, even if you have to make up something, you know, sometimes you're feeling so down that, because I definitely have people that are depressed that I work with, that you can still find something that's good. I mean, when we have a break in the clouds in the northwest and we see blue sky, hey, I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
So hold on to those things. Hold on to the fact that there are flowers that are starting to come up. I've got crocuses in my front yard. You know, be grateful for those things if you can't bring it to yourself personally yet. Work through it until every day you can make the shift. And the other thing, too, to help with that is do something physical for yourself. When you start doing something physical for yourself, then you start feeling better about yourself. Your attitude changes, and then again, it's easier to become grateful.
It releases those endorphins, right?
Mm-hmm. And it could be getting a massage. As a woman, you go have your nails done, or go by when they're doing those free makeup do-overs at
just
the mall.
Do it. Yeah.
Go do that. For a man, go have your hair cut differently. Whatever it is, buy a new shirt. Whatever it takes just to do something physically. It could even be exercise, massage, changing how your desk is. Something in your physical world, because that means you're making an effort for you, and it's amazing, because that's where our first level of self-esteem goes, is in our physical appearance, our physical being. So then you get to that point where you do something physical for yourself, you start feeling better about you, you become more grateful, and again, my old adage is fake it till you make it. So again, if you can't find anything at the moment to be grateful for the blue sky, be grateful for the fact that it's been snowing for the last couple of days.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to let you give out your information, your contact info for phone readings to help people and wind up the show. Go ahead and close it off.
Oh, you are wonderful, Mike. That's I'm most appreciative, and sounds like the first hour was fabulous. You can contact me at CandiaSanders.com or my phone number, which is 360-608-9555. Please go onto my website. Check out the stories and testimonials from people. It's lots of fun. So have a great week, and we look forward to having you listen to us again next week here on BBS Radio on the Odyssey Show with Mike and Candia.
Bye-bye.
Bye.